Good evening, everyone. Good evening and welcome to the Kansas City Public Library's Truman Forum. My name is Alex Burden. I'm the Executive Director of the Truman Library Institute, the nonprofit partner of the Truman Library. And on behalf of the Institute's Board of Directors, many of whom are with us this evening, I want to welcome you to this evening's program, When Kansas City Went to War. I'd like to begin by thanking Crosby Kemper, Chepto Cositani, Henry Fortunato, and all the public library staff for all their efforts to make this program possible tonight, and for providing the Truman Library Institute with such a wonderful venue for the numerous lectures we present here in the appropriately named Truman Forum. With tonight's program, the Truman Library Institute is launching a year-long series of programs to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. These programs are designed to honor the sacrifice and service of America's greatest generation, celebrate President Truman's decisive leadership during the final months of the war, and teach citizens of all ages the lessons of history and the importance of defending America and our precious form of government. I would love to provide you with the details of these initiatives, but I'm not that stupid. I realize that you're not here to hear Alex Burden talk, but our distinguished panel, which will be with you in just a moment. However, I would like to provide you with a few details and then refer to how you could get additional information. We have a wonderful museum exhibit starting next week called Till We Meet Again, The Greatest Generation in War and Peace. It will feature some absolutely fantastic documents and artifacts, both from the National Archives, but also in Washington, D.C., but also the Truman Library. We have several more installments of this lecture series, which begins tonight, that runs through September, and we have signature commemorations coming up this summer, including VE Day, VJ Day, I hope you all know what those mean, as well as Wild About Harry, that takes place in just over a month. I would like to say a little bit about Wild About Harry. It's the Truman Library Institute's largest community program, best fundraiser. We will be formally honoring Mr. Dunn, Block, and Matheny, as well as Senator Bob Dole with the Truman Legacy of Leadership Award at that program. The entry point is fairly affordable. We already have a huge crowd coming, and I hope you'll join us. And I hope you'll join us for a number of these programs. You can get more information on our website, trumanlibraryinstitute.org, or we have some attractive folders out at our table in the kiosk. These are calendars that shows everything that we're doing, ranging from those things that I mentioned to educational programs for students. So please pick one of those up on your way out. And programs like this one tonight would not be possible without the generous support of many friends, and I'd like to especially thank our World War II title sponsor, the Veterans of the Foreign Wars of the United States, Brigadier General Jack and Marie Capps, the presenting sponsor of our lecture series, and the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation, who strategically supports many of our highest profile community activities. A full listing of our sponsors are available in the program booklet. Now to tonight's lecture, which I'm extremely excited to introduce to you. Many of us have read some of the classic books on the Second World War, seen movies, war movies, both new and old, and are familiar with the history of the decisive events that took place during the war. Fewer of us, however, have had the opportunity to hear firsthand accounts about the service of World War II veterans. Both of my grandfathers served in the war, and I didn't hear one story from either one of them. Tonight, we have the privilege to hear the personal stories from three of Kansas City's leading citizens. Before we go on any further, however, I'd like to take a moment and recognize any other World War II veterans that might be with us. I think Jerry Nerman, are you, Jerry, are you here? Like Jerry, if you don't mind standing, wave. Jerry's down front. I know that. Thank you. And a second World War II veteran is here, is Monty Allen. Are you, could you raise your hand? Monty, thank you for your service. It's an honor to have you with us tonight. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. And I'd now like to introduce tonight's moderator and get off the stage. David Von Draley will be the person in charge of our panel. David is an editor at large for Time magazine, where he covered politics, breaking news, and the Supreme Court since 2007. David has written numerous articles for Time magazine, including nearly 50 cover stories. He is also an acclaimed author of several books, including one of the best books ever written about Abraham Lincoln called Rise to Greatness. David will be introducing our three panelists, and I'd like to end by thanking them for being with us tonight, participating in tonight's program, Wild About Harry, and the generous support that they have provided to the Truman Library for decades. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Von Draley, Henry Block, Ed Matheny, and Bill Dunn Sr. to the stage, and thanking them for the service to our country.
Thank you all very much for coming out tonight for this remarkable event with these three gentlemen that I've been lucky to be getting to know in the past few days. A catastrophe of almost unimaginable scale. World War II left more than 60 million human beings dead, or 3 of every 100 people on Earth. It was an event that stamped the lives of every American, and especially the lives of the young men and women who served in the U.S. Armed Forces. World War II called for sacrifice from every social stratum and every walk of life, and an entire generation answered that call bravely, even eagerly, for they understood that cherished ideals of human dignity and individual freedom were literally at stake. Easily more than 500,000 Missouri and Kansas citizens served during the war, from raw teenagers who had not yet finished high school to Omar Bradley of Missouri and Dwight Eisenhower of Kansas. Three of those individuals are with us here tonight to share and reflect on their experiences in this terrible yet galvanizing war that ended 70 years ago this year during the opening months of the world-shaping presidency of Kansas City's own Harry S. Truman. These men really need no introduction to a Kansas City audience, as your welcome indicated, but they are such humble individuals that I do want to talk a little bit about each of the men you're going to hear from. Henry W. Block was a student at the University of Michigan when the United States entered the war. Having learned in school the horrors of trench warfare in what was then known as the Great War, World War I, he resolved to do his service above ground and enlisted in the Army Air Corps. Trained as a navigator, he was assigned to the 8th Air Force, 95th Bomb Group, and as it turned out, Henry had chosen the most perilous service of World War II, the rough equivalent of serving as an infantryman in a World War I trench. The eminent historian of World War II, Rick Atkinson, has written of the very period when Henry was in flying, quote, "The losses were dreadful. Only 1 in 4 8th Air Force bomber crews could expect to complete the minimum quota of 25 missions. Henry Bloch completed 31 missions, including a raid on Berlin, for which the 95th was awarded its third presidential unit citation, making it the only unit of the Air Force to win three during the war. Restored to civilian life, Mr. Bloch joined with his brother Richard to build one of Kansas City's great entrepreneurial triumphs, H&R Block. And with his late wife Marion, he's forged a philanthropic career that will benefit Kansas Cityans for many generations to come. From the Henry W. Bloch School of Management at UMKC to the architecturally acclaimed Bloch Building of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, to the priceless collection of paintings that he and his wife donated to the museum, to the Marion Bloch Neuroscience Institute at St. Luke's Health System, to the Marion and Henry Bloch Family Foundation in Kansas City, it can literally be said of this man, as was once said of London's Christopher Wren, if you seek his monument, look around you. The same could literally be said of Bill Dunn, who built this building that we're sitting in. He was a student at Notre Dame University when he was not working at his father's construction company as a laborer paid a dollar a day. He followed his older brother, Ernie Jr., into the service, enlisting in the United States Navy as an aviator. In those days, before satellite reconnaissance, Mr. Dunn was trained to fly what very likely were suicide missions, low-altitude scouting flights in slow, lightly armored, single-engine seaplanes. He was preparing to take part in the invasion of the Japanese home islands when President Truman's decision to deploy the atomic bombs brought an end to the war. Back home, Mr. Dunn built his father's firm, J.E. Dunn Construction, into one of the largest and most admired contractors in the United States. Its cranes and crews can be seen on state-of-the-art projects from coast to coast and, as Henry pointed out, right across the street. He and his wife also imbued his family and his colleagues at the company with a passion for charitable giving and philanthropic leadership. I'll cite just one statistic, a commitment made by Mr. Dunn that continues to this day. Every year, more than 10% of pre-tax earnings at J.E. Dunn goes to charity. Edward T. Matheny was captain of the basketball team at the University of Missouri when the war found him. Graduating on an accelerated schedule, Mr. Matheny entered the United States Navy, where his talents were quickly spotted, and he was assigned to the staff of Admiral Chester Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief of the War in the Pacific. As a plotting officer, it fell to Ed and his colleagues to track the movements of every known vessel in the world's largest ocean, friend and foe. Assigned first to Pearl Harbor and later to Guam, Mr. Matheny was among the officers who entered Japan after VJ Day to begin the work of the American occupation. After the war, he attended Harvard Law School and then joined the Kansas City firm of Caldwell Downing as its 10th lawyer. After decades of growth, much of it led by Mr. Matheny as managing partner, that little outfit has grown to become the international firm of Hush Blackwell, right upstairs, employing more than 500 attorneys in 16 offices. In his quote-unquote retirement, Mr. Matheny has become an important historian of Kansas City and its institutions. His 7 books tell the stories of his law firm, of St. Luke's Hospital, of the West Bottoms, and most relevant to this evening, Kansas City's experience in World War II. These three men have been friends and tennis partners for many years, and yet, characteristically of that generation that has been justly called the greatest, they've never discussed their war experiences until Ed began asking as research for his book, incidentally called The Pursuit of a Ruptured Duck, When Kansas Cityans Went to War. Indeed, they're still learning new details from one another, and we are fortunate indeed to learn some of them in their presence tonight. I'm going to start with you, Mr. Block. Tell us, if you would, how you wound up in 1944 at Horam Airfield in England, and what that first raid on Berlin was like.
Okay. Pearl Harbor happened. I was playing that Sunday in a bridge tournament at Michigan. Then we declared war Japan, everybody wanted to help out. I knew that they all wanted to do something, enlist and so on. But all I could think about was World War I and people living in trenches, and that was the last thing I wanted to do. And so I saw an ad in a magazine that said, if you enlist in the Air Force and you're going to college, we'll let you finish your education in college before we call you in the Air Force. And I said, that sounds excellent. So I enlisted, but lo and behold, that was my junior year. And my senior year, they called me into active duty. They went back on their word. But when Uncle Sam says, we want you, you go.
You go.
So I went down to the Union Station, got in a train, went down to Texas to SAC, San Antonio Aviation Cadet. And you take a... I told my mother... I would probably be a navigator, and her health wasn't too good, but they didn't complain about that. So you take a physical test, and I took that test and ranked very high, and they called me in and said, you have your choice. You can either be a pilot, co-pilot, navigator, bombardier. You want to be a navigator? And I said, well, I guess I'll change, be a pilot.
Be a pilot.
So I called home, and I was pretty excited, and I told my mother that I've changed from navigator to being a pilot. And she said, if you do, your father's going to go to Washington and get you out of service. As if he could. So I said, okay, Mom, I'll go back to being a navigator. What she was trying to say is, I don't have a lot of confidence in you. Sit in the plane and not fly. So that's...
And that...
So I took my navigation training, took my aerial gunnery down near Mexico, which incidentally I got an excellent expert medal in an open cockpit plane and shooting. Went all through my training and then went to England and went to Horam, as you mentioned. We lived in a Nissen hut, they called it. It was a long, long oval hut. He said, that's your bed up there. They were all double beds. I was taking everything and throwing it in a bag. And I said, well, what are you doing? I thought I'm going to sleep there. He said, yeah, but that guy that had it last night got shot down today. So that was my welcome. And the 95th was a great group. It was the first one over Berlin. And my first mission was over Berlin, as you mentioned. And what you do, the pilot, you fly to what they call an IP, initial point, which is generally about 10 minutes from the target. And you have an escort of fighter planes to keep the German planes away from you. The fighter planes, P-51s, P-47s, P-38s, they do a wonderful job. And because we were in B-18s, and they were slow, and we needed these fighter pilots to keep the Germans away from us. And but once you go to the initial point, your people don't go. They don't go with you because of the danger. And when we got to over Berlin to drop our bombs, and we're not allowed to take evasive action either. If we see a lot of bombs exploding somewhere, we have to keep flying from the initial point to the center of the target. And we got all shot up on that mission. We lost three engines, and fuel was leaking, and so we couldn't stay with our group. We had to keep coming down. We were very lucky that we didn't see any German fighter planes as we headed back to England. And when we landed in England, we were out of gas. So that was my welcome.
And they made you do it 30 more times. That's Ed, tell us your story.
Well, my naval career, such as it was, got started in midshipman school. I was a 90-day wonder. And when I graduated, I was fortunate enough to be sent to the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, Chester Nimitz, at Pearl Harbor. And on my way west, I stopped at the Union Station, and my mother and father came down and told me goodbye. And then I rode the Santa Fe Chief to San Francisco, spent a couple days there, and I heard about the Top of the Mark. So I wanted to go to the Top of the Mark Hopkins Hotel, which I did. But I wasn't old enough to get in. That changed a couple days later when I caught an LST for Pearl Harbor, and that was a 10-day trip. Those LSTs were not real fast. The initials LST stood for Landing Ship Tank, but were appropriately dubbed Large Slow Target. When we arrived at Pearl, it happened to be the same day that President Roosevelt arrived on a cruiser, and he was meeting with General MacArthur and Admiral Nimitz to help solve a problem about whether they were going to attack the Philippines or Formosa first. So we sat in our humble man of war out in the bay while the president went ashore. And of course, he was greeted by a lot of gold braid, and quite a line of admirals really lined up to meet him. And the chief of staff for Admiral Nimitz, Sock McMorris was his name, ordered them eyes right, and two of them promptly turned left. I didn't see that, but that was a story, and it was apparently a very delightful thing for the sailors to observe because it confirmed a lot of their privately held views.
Oh, Admiral.
So I was assigned to Flag Plot, which was in the on a large fortress kind of building at Pearl, and that's where I spent a lot of my time before I went with the Admiral out to Guam. I'll stop with that there. Bill?
You know, I had a very similar situation. We were all in college or university, and we were probably all shocked at the same time by Pearl Harbor. But it was kind of amazing. I think that it had been anticipated, although I think the media painted it as a total shock, because my father was a very small contractor at that time, and probably within a month or two after Pearl Harbor, they took bids on a quartermaster depot here in Kansas City. And he was the low bidder. In those days, everything was competitively bid. And so it started. Seemed to me like they only had like 120 working days to turn this over. And my brother, who was 4 years older, he was an assistant superintendent on this program. I probably started to work after I finished my sophomore year at Rockhurst College, but before going up to University of Notre Dame. But I was a laborer, and I vividly remember working 77 straight days, 10 hours a day, and making up my mind I was never going to see another construction job as long as I lived. Because really, the year before, my father always insisted that his children and my mother, that was the same way, stay very busy when they weren't in school. So I was handed the assignment the year before that there was about a three-story school building that the company was building. And I got a laborer's card. Laborers at that time were making 45 cents an hour, but it was before the war. They talk about a recession now, but it was really a depression then. And when I reported for work, I had to transfer twice on a bus. And they said, we can't pay you the laborer's wages. You're listed as the water boy. And I said, okay, I'm supposed to work this summer. Tell me, what does a water boy get? That was a dollar a day, 12 and a half cents an hour.
12 and a half.
I didn't make any money that summer, but I did play football the next year for Rockhurst College when they had a football team. They don't have one anymore. And I was in pretty good shape. Today they wouldn't have let me even be the water boy for a football team because I weighed 155 pounds and we went both ways. It's a wonder I didn't get killed, but I didn't. But I happened to be, I'd already enrolled and had been accepted after my sophomore year to the University of Notre Dame. My dad wanted me to get a degree in engineering because there were very few people had college degrees. I think the movement that the government had about anyone that had been in the military would be able to get their tuition for free when they came back, if they came back. Anyway, I was in the same program that Ed was. They called us 90 Day Wonders. I was a junior. I went down during the Christmas vacation to see my brother get his wings down at Pensacola, Florida. I immediately thought to myself, I don't want to be sitting around one more year when I could switch. Well, they insisted that I was in the Naval Reserve. They insisted I go into Chicago, and I took a lot of tests, and I it had a lot of subjects dealing with math and physics and issues like that. So after these tests, they agreed that, yeah, you can go to the Air Corps. I was really kind of surprised, though, when I finally got called that they had lengthened the program. My brother went right to primary, which is, that was where they flew. They called them the Yellow Perils. You couldn't kill yourself in one of these Stearmans, but they were biplanes. So while I was waiting around, I finished my junior year at the University of Notre Dame, and while I was waiting around, my dad said, well, you're going to have to stay busy. So I was working as a laborer, and they were putting another floor on what is now the De La Salle facility for handicapped young people. While I was waiting, I get a call from the math teacher, who was very bright, had written several books at Rutgers College, and he said, I need some help. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we have the Army Air Corps boys, and they had about a 3-month training program. They said, I want you to teach celestial navigation to these Army Air Corps cadets. I said, I've never had that science before. He said, I'll keep you 1 week ahead of the students. And ironically, he did keep me ahead, and they thought I was probably a slacker that had gotten out of going on duty. But I finally told him, I said, I appreciated working with you Army Air Corps cadets. Maybe we'll cross our places somewhere, because I'm going into the Navy Air Corps. And as I left the room, I got a loud boo from all the Army Corps. Ironically, they had lengthened the program by almost 10 months before I ever got to primary. But ironically, they sent me to Cornell College up in Mount Vernon, Iowa. I discovered that many of us had been juniors and seniors in college, and we came to the end of the training program before our next assignment, and they said there were, in my particular platoon, they were all pretty bright young people. They said, we're going to give you a special course called Celestial Navigation. They said, also, we're going to give you a very tough test at the end of the course to see how you absorb what's going on. So we took the test. I was called into the main office, and they said, Cadet, we have a problem. Where did you find these answers before the test? Because if you cheated, you're out of here, and you're going to be a seaman is what you're going to be. I explained to them that I had taught the course for about 2 months. And so they forgave me, and I went on then to a flight school where we flew light planes. As I remember, they were tailored crafts, and they would stay afloat if the wind was, I think, more than about 50 or 60 miles an hour. Our plane was flying backwards all the time. But anyway, we survived that, and that was 3 months. The next step was Iowa pre-flight. Well, when I went to Iowa pre-flight, my last flight when I was in this tailor craft, all of a sudden, it felt like there was a knife in my stomach. And I told them, I said, I can't get out of the plane. Someone's going to have to help me. Well, they ran me over to the University of Iowa Hospital. They took a bunch of tests. And they said, you have an appendix that's about to burst. I said, well, do what you have to do. So anyway, I've had a lot of things happen. Maybe it's fate. But I think I lost several weeks. But I finally went to Iowa pre-flight. And that was all half days physical, all types of sports and hand-to-hand and judo and all those things. The other half was all schoolwork. That was a three-month program. It's kind of ironic. The commander of the base had been the football, he'd played for Notre Dame, but he'd been the football coach at St. Benedict's, which is now Benedictine. And he knew I was there, but the day that our group was supposed to move on, he called me. I'd never met him. I'd met him when he was being the coach up at St. Benedict's, but he had me over for a Sunday dinner. I got a lot of razzing from the other cadets. But all of a sudden, they had a meeting, and they said, to our whole battalion up there, they said, you know, we got bad news for you people. We've discovered only half the pilots are getting killed that we thought were going to get killed. So they washed out half of our people, and they sent them to Great Lakes. They said, you can either go home or be called again, or you can stay in the Navy as a seaman. Well, I was fortunate enough that I was pretty good in athletics, and one battalion had to play another battalion. They didn't have the Big 12 in those days, but they had the Big 6. And the other battalion had an all-Big 6 quarterback from Iowa State. But the man that drove me crazy, because most of our battalion, none of them had played college football, and I had to do most of the tackling. See, he came straight from the Chicago Bears. He was their starting fullback. My lieutenant said, oh, I'm going to give you a 4-0 on all my reports. But I said, yeah, where are you going to send the body? I said, I've never taken such a beating all my life. So anyway, I was one of the ones that was fortunate enough to stay. But then they announced, well, we don't have any room for any of you people. You're going to have to wait a while to go into primary flight training. That was where my brother first started. So they sent us up to Minneapolis, where we worked on a flight line up there for about 2 months. Finally, we got the call to go to primary flight training. It was a facility outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And it was quite a surprise to me, because when we came in there, I heard all these boos, and I looked around, what's going on? I heard them saying, here come the damn Yankees. We never talked about the Civil War when I was growing up. But in any event, we went through primary flight training and then had the opportunity to go to Pensacola. But that was another situation that was unknown to me, is that when you got to your final squadron, I enjoyed it flying a lot. But when you got to final squadron, they made the decision whether you were Navy, whether you were the Marine, or whether you were Coast Guard. Of course, we all thought we were going to be hot fighter pilots. Instead, they let us know that the military had planned on a long war, and that the battleships and the cruisers, they usually sent their shells from maybe 4 or 5 miles away from wherever they were trying to take an island. They said, you're going to be trained to be the single-engine seaplane people. So the only really exciting about that was we were catapulted off of either a cruiser or a battleship. And it's the reason I don't hear very well and have hearing aids, is it was a tremendous explosion right underneath the plane. And they told us to be sure to make sure that we were holding the stick like this. Don't do that, but put it back against there, because it was such a jolt in 70 feet, I think it was. You went from zero to 100 miles an hour, and so that you could keep flying. You know, I think enough of us got our brains knocked out that I even end up going into the construction business. But I'm really flattered to be on this this group of people here. Here are my two best friends, but boy, were they mean on the tennis court. I met them just by accident. I had a very good friend who also was a Navy pilot, but went to Southwest High School, where they both went to school. And he called me one day when I was 50 years old. He said, "Don't you get tired of working about 7 days a week and 10 hours a day?" I said, "Yeah, I sure do. But what are you suggesting?" He said, "Why don't you get some exercise? It doesn't hurt. You were a pretty good athlete growing up. Why don't we play tennis?" And he said, "I've got two friends from Southwest, Henry Block and Ed Matheny. I never met either one of these people, but I learned they were fierce on the tennis court. Henry and I were both right-handers, and we played these other two were left-handers. Finally, Ed Matheny called me one day, and he said, 'You know, this rivalry is so tough, we won't be friends very long. I'd have to get psyched up to play, but we each one of us would maybe win every other time.' But I really had the privilege of meeting two great guys right here, and they're still my best friends I'll probably ever have."
Wow.
I should say that when I was on the battleship New Jersey, I watched them launch those Kingfisher scout planes that Bill's talking about that he was on. And it was like being shot out of a cannon. There'd be this explosion, and those things would go from 0 to 100 miles an hour in about 90 feet. And it was like a circus act almost. Except they had a net in the circus, and and these guys didn't have one.
Henry, Bill used the phrase "get psyched up." He was talking about tennis, but I can hardly imagine how you crews in the 8th Air Force managed to get psyched up for those missions, knowing... You told me yesterday that you rarely came back without holes in your airplane.
But it was just part of our job. We wake us up about 5:30, and we'd go to... We flew during the day. The RAF flew at night. So that was, I thought, a good break for the Americans. and then I went to a meeting of navigators. Everybody went to a different meeting, and I thought I was very lucky, because we had a crew of 10, 4 officers and 6 enlisted men. The other 9 were Catholic, and they got together before every mission, had a little mass. And I felt like I was getting a free ride. But we'd go to a room, and all the navigators, and they'd say, "Today we're going to bomb Schweinfurt or somewhere." And then after we flew the mission, then we met with intelligence. And they wanted to know what we did, what we saw, what we would try to improve, and so on. And I thought it was run very well. We were very lucky. And, I was only maybe not 21 years old, and... But I can remember seeing cold sweat running down my back that I just didn't know about.
Did you have any superstitions?
Well, our pilot got married right before we left, and his wife gave him her lipstick, and he, before every mission, he rubbed it on his hand. And I think that helped too. But
tell that story about when you got up to look over the bombardier's shoulder.
Yeah, on one particular mission, we were bombing the Palestine oil fields, And I wanted to see where the bombs were falling and what was happening. And I sat right to the side and a little behind the bombardier. So I looked over his shoulder, and I'd see the bombs falling and the smoke coming up and so on. And then I went back to my seat, and it was gone. There was just a big hole in the side of the plane. But we were shot up, I guess, on about every mission. But we were very fortunate. 71% of in the 8th Air Force died. So that's why they, when I went over there, it was 25 missions. You mentioned 31. But then they raised it to 30. And then they finally raised it to 35 because there were so many casualties. And when they raised it to 35, I had 31. So they said, you can either go home or you can have another tour of duty. And, so I think I'll come home. We were very lucky. But
Ed, you tell the story in your book about the day that you heard that President Roosevelt had died, and all your fellow sailors figured that you must know a lot about the new president because you were from Kansas City.
Yes, I was on Guam at that point, and they knew that Kansas City was a close neighbor of Independence, where Harry Truman came from, and like just about everybody else, they didn't know all that much about Harry Truman. And they said, what about this guy? Well, I had grown up in Kansas City, and the local newspaper, the Kansas City Star, at that time was a pretty rock-ribbed Republican paper. And as far as they were concerned, Harry Truman was a senator from Pendergast. So I didn't give him a very good build when I told him about what I thought our prospects were with the new president. Of course, I couldn't have been more mistaken, because I had transferred from the Nimitz to the 5th Fleet Spruance, and I had found out that hadn't been the smartest thing I'd ever done. And when I reported to Admiral Spruance on the first day of August 1945, and at that point they were getting ready for the invasion of Japan, and I recall vividly what he said. He said, are you looking for excitement? And, well, 6 days later, of course, thanks to President Truman, the atom bomb was dropped. A couple of days after that, there was another one. And that certainly saved my bacon, as well as that those guys who were going to be flying those Kingfishers.
You said something very powerful about that the other day, Bill.
I'm here today because of Harry Truman dropping the two bombs. I had been assigned to the battleship Wisconsin, which was going out for the big push, and it was going to be island for island. My brother was on the West Coast going out the second time. When he went out the first time, he landed at Midway, right after the Battle of Midway. He'd been assigned to the Marine pilots. He flew an SBD, SB-2C, and then others. He was also assigned to be a bomber pilot in the Marianas. I think it was an island of Majuro. They weren't counting how many. I guess they had fly several missions almost every day, because before he came back first time, he had 118 bombing missions.
Wow.
His plane got shot up a number of times. In fact, he told me, he said, those Japs are pretty good pilots, and and they're also pretty good gunners. But I really appreciate what Harry Truman did. You know, a lot of people criticized him for dropping the two bombs, but I know everyone has said later we'd have probably lost at least another million men if he hadn't dropped those two bombs, because I reported the battleship Wisconsin, they had five pilots, just about the same time that Harry dropped the two bombs. We'd never even heard about the two bombs, but he stopped the war, that's for sure.
You know, I just by coincidence, a friend of mine emailed me yesterday morning and to ask a question about Harry Truman. And he said, I know about the bomb and that he was a regular guy, but what else did he do? And off the top of my head, I just jotted out a list. Post-war famine relief that saved tens of millions of European lives. Took over responsibility for the freedom of Greece from the UK when they decided to surrender their responsibility over a weekend, which preserved Turkey for the West. Created NATO, the Berlin Airlift, creation of the United Nations, the Marshall Plan, recognition of Israel, the creation of the Department of Defense, which is the largest reorganization of the federal government in history. Desegregated the armed forces, desegregated the federal civil service, which made him, up to that time, probably the greatest president other than Lincoln on civil rights. Fired the great war hero MacArthur rather than invade China and bring on a nuclear war. Bretton Woods, the international monetary system, and so on and so on. A truly great president. Ed, you talked really beautifully. Henry, I want you to tell this great story before we run out of time. You saw the invasion of Normandy.
Yeah, I flew three missions that day on D-Day. And we didn't know when we got up in the morning and went out. They said, well, today is the day. We knew it was close, but none of us knew exactly when D-Day would happen. And we took off, and we didn't take off like you do when you get in an airplane. You go like that. We had to go like this to get up, because in England there were American bases, airplane bases, all over the place. And we didn't want to run into another airplane. but they were easy missions for flying, because we dropped our bombs over the English Channel. We were going like that, and the bomb would go forward and land on the land to soften it up. They weren't very difficult. Then we'd just come back. They were short missions because we were near the channel to begin with. And
what did it look like down below?
Thousands of boats. Literally thousands of boats.
And, ships.
what did he say?
It's ships, not boats. Boat. Ships.
Ships. Pardon me.
Did you think, it just occurs to me to ask you this, did you think, another one of these historical controversies, should the president have targeted the rail lines to the concentration camps for bombing? Do you wish you could have dropped bombs?
Well, you mean on the concentration camps?
Outside Auschwitz.
Killing people, you mean?
No, blowing up the train tracks.
Oh, the train tracks. Oh. Of course, we were assigned targets.
Right.
That was never a target. I'm not sure how much we knew about those camps.
Okay.
When we flew. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they were obviously horrible places, but I don't say I did know or didn't know. I just don't recall. And we only bombed what we were told to bomb.
Sure.
But we bombed railroad tracks, you were right, and we never bombed people. But we must have killed lots of people, because in most of the source, when we flew, we had 1,000 planes up there, all dropping bombs.
Wow.
When the lead plane dropped its bomb, we all dropped. So we covered a huge area, 1,000 airplanes, all dropping their bombs at the same time. And but, of course, we couldn't aim them that well, so...
Bill, your dad became famous here at home for one of his decisions during the war.
He made up his mind that he wanted not to make one dime during the war. And he was the first contractor that actually told the, I think it was the Corps of Engineers may have been in charge of the quartermaster depot. He said, I do not want to make a dime out of this. He had discovered he was a small contractor, but he had been a low bidder, and it turned out that they'd made $180,000. They didn't know how to handle that, so finally they agreed it would be a change order, that he would turn back just $180,000. President Truman was still vice president. President Roosevelt wrote a very nice letter, and he said, I hope other contractors would do this. Well, when they finished that one, they were in need of housing where the bomber plant, we were putting together the B-25 bombers. They needed some help there, and he worked with the Corps of Engineers and did that for no fee, and then went out to Eudora where they were making the powder for bombs. And that was done at no expense. The Corps of Engineers offered him a brigadier's general assignment if he would go to Alaska, because the Japanese had landed on some of the... And my mother was a very tough German lady. She said, you're not going to be any brigadier general. He was a very unusual patriot, and he gave me a lot of good advice when he insisted I at least try the business side of construction, and I've always tried to follow his advice, and there's very few contractors. I will soon be there 69 years, which most of the employees think it's about 30 years too much. They keep hoping if I'm going to stop working, I better die first or something like that. But, you know, I had one very interesting situation. When I finished Pensacola, I think they were still concerned that there might be some German subs lurking around. And so we would go on 4-hour hops from Pensacola to check that. And I had an instructor one day who said, don't think you're ever going to find anybody. He said, you know, there was one situation that occurred, and they sold a lot of war bonds. It was titled Sighted Sub Sank Same. He said, I was an instructor at that base, and it'll never come out. We sold a lot of bonds, but the pilot that sank that sub, it was our own U.S. sub that got sunk.
You mentioned that Harry Truman fired General MacArthur, and this was, of course, during the Korean War, but I'm sure that the Navy approved of that. there was quite a power struggle, maybe an overstatement, but between MacArthur and Nimitz in World War II, the Navy, MacArthur had a pretty good PR system, and the Navy felt that the Marine Corps and the Navy ought to get some credit for what was going on in the Pacific.
Since they were doing all the fighting, right.
And Admiral Nimitz was the kind of guy that would pat you on the back and say, let's go at it together, and that wasn't MacArthur's
style.
That was not his style.
Ed, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, when we went over to England from the United States, we went over on the Queen Elizabeth or the Queen Mary and came back on the other one. And going over and coming back, we had to take evasive action all the way. Imagine going to Europe. We'd go this way, this way, this way, so we wouldn't get hit by submarines. And but coming back, and you know, maybe I shouldn't tell this story, but
definitely tell it.
coming back, Churchill was coming back on the same boat, and he decided a little bit late that he was coming back on it, and not coming to America. He was going to go to Canada, but they held the boat up for him. There were a lot of injured people on the boat. Some died. It took about a week to get the boat fixed up for him. When he came out on deck, we all had to be in our room. We couldn't be on deck. Our pilot was walking around the ship one day. And he saw an open door, and he went in it, and there was Churchill. And he saluted him, you know. And, it kind of left a bad thing, a taste in our mouth. A lot of people died because the ship was held up a week, and we were in a stateroom, with all double-deck beds almost touching each other, and it wasn't very luxurious.
Didn't your pilot, Frank Pesota, right?
Pesota, P-S-O-T-A.
He said something to Churchill.
He didn't know whose room he went in until Churchill came out, and then he saluted him, and...
I think I read in Tom's book that he said, sir, can you tell me how to get out of here without getting shot?
Yeah.
Ed, I could go on all night, but we're near our published stopping time, or maybe even a little past. But you said something so great yesterday morning when we met about the way in which World War II called on the entire society, not just, you know, as our wars do now, certain groups of people who serve, and the rest of us, it's almost as if we're not at war. And you talked about that one of Kansas City's most prominent families actually gave the ultimate sacrifice in that war. Why don't you tell that story?
Well, we were all in it together. And rich or poor, famous or infamous. And a good example of that was the Kemper family. Jim Kemper was with the cavalry, and he went ashore at Leyte and fought his way to Manila. In the process, he got the Purple Heart. And 10 days before VE Day, his older brother David was killed on a dangerous reconnaissance mission in Italy. And that fountain at 8th and Main, downtown Kansas City, is a memorial to David. And that's a good example of how everybody in the country, we were all in the war, and the people that stayed at home, we kind of felt sorry for the 4Fs because they were going to miss out on things, but it was a unanimous will to win.
Well, we'll have to leave on that note. I do want to thank the Kansas City Public Library and the leadership there who make this one of the finest library systems in the country, especially for public programming. Also, Alex Burden and the Truman Library Institute, which is, as he said at the beginning of the show, committed to marking the end of World War II and the beginning of the Truman presidency throughout this 70th anniversary year. Indeed, I'll reiterate Alex's invitation to as many of you as possible to join us next month for the Wild About Harry dinner, where Rick Atkinson, the eminent historian that I quoted at the beginning of the program, will be the featured speaker. These gentlemen will be honored along with Senator Robert Dole, who we all know gave a tremendous sacrifice and left a part of himself on the battlefields of Italy. But my most profound thanks to Bill and Ed and Henry for what you did then and for all you've done since then. It's been a singular honor for me to sit up here with you this evening.
Oh, honor for us to be with you.